There's no.
Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. My name's Theo Finnegan, and I'm talking to Sarah Crover from VIU's English department. On Friday, September 20th, from 10 till 11:30 in the Malaspina Theatre, Sarah will give a presentation titled Shakespearean Neverwheres, Victoria BC, Anne Hathaway's Cottage, and Nostalgia for Merry Old England. This talk will explore how Victoria's citizens in the mid-20th century mobilized Shakespeare and a sanitized vision of the past to imagine a venerable, harmonious, English city. Hi, Sarah. Can you tell us a little bit about the replica Shakespeare House in Victoria? So when was it built? Who built it? Whose idea was it? And what happened to it?
Yeah, so it was built in the 50s. I think the sort of grand opening was July 1959. They were aiming for an opening that coincided with Queen Elizabeth's visit, but they looks like, as far as the newspaper articles tell me, they missed it by about a month. The whole project was the brainchild of Sam and I think it was Rosie Lane. I'd have to double check. Definitely Sam Lane. He's fairly well known in the Victoria tourism industry because he was one of the main architects of the sort of mid-century tourism face of Victoria. So his wife was actually born and raised in Victoria, but went to school in England. He was an RAF pilot. Right after World War II, they married and they came back to Canada. And they were already avid, I think, amateur historians, you would say, and collectors of antiques. And they brought this with them and they came up with this plan. They bought a beautiful cottage. Well, it wasn't really, they called it Rose Cottage or Rosemead for a while before it became the Old English Inn, but it was basically a mock Tudor mansion constructed by Sam McClure in the 1910s. And so they turn that into the Old English Inn, and then they start expanding. And one of their big plans, they go further than this, but their big plan was to create a replica of Anne Hathaway's cottage in Stratford-upon-Avon. And I think the thinking was that Victoria needed novelty attractions. They weren't... There, of course, there was still a lot of reticence about sort of drawing upon the sort of actual lived history of Victoria. Victoria was actually quite a ramshackle place during its early colonial days. And of course, they really didn't want to talk about whose land it belonged to originally, or the sort of immigrant population that largely helped build it, which was mostly not white. And so, yeah, they build this project, and it is quite successful. They hire a master thatcher from the Saanich Peninsula. They get the hay in, and they produce this replica in consultation, I should say, with the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust in England. So they even replicate the garden, which is kind of funny because the garden at Stratford-upon-Avon is, of course, itself a pastiche and reimagining of like what it might have been like in Shakespeare's day. So that was the goal. And then they sort of create this kind of pastiche English, old Englishness. They have high teas there, which of course is not something that happened in Shakespeare's day. They've got like Sunday roasts. It becomes a place for women's clubs and bridal showers, as well as a big draw for American tourists, because one of the things that's happening is Victoria is trying to define itself against Vancouver on the one hand, which had ultimately ended up with most of the major industry of the West Coast of Canada, and more importantly, differentiate itself from the United States. And one of the big draws was to sort of capitalize on its otherness and its quaintness.
So it's interesting that quaintness, which used to, you know, I was in Victoria in the summer, and it's obviously more than this as well. And it's changed, and it's a growing city and so on, and it's lovely, but there's sort of appeals to quaintness still, right?
For sure.
The Empress and high tea you can have there.
The red double-decker bus.
Right, sticky wicket, like sort of Anglophile terminology. It's interesting that this quaintness is quite artificial.
Yeah, it's also strange because as a university student, I worked in the tourist industry in Victoria because I was at UVic. And so on the one hand, like we were surrounded by all the, you know, we were directing tourists to all the other tourist attractions. And we were hyper aware of the sort of strangeness of it. Like there was a Madame Tussauds wax museum knockoff and various things like that. A lot of my friends worked as tour guides at Anne Hathaway's cottage. But we would also get the commentary from the tourists leaving, because I worked at the Coho Ferry. And even some of the English tourists would say things like, oh, it's more English than England, which was such an odd thing to say, because it was clearly gesturing towards some sort of like pretend Englishness, you know. And on the other hand, a friend of mine from Sweden came to visit and was like, why? What is all this? Like, where did this come from? This isn't England. What are they doing? So
is it that there's a kind of and because the same thing, that there's a city in New Zealand where I'm from called Christchurch, which has a about same size as Victoria, and it has a similar kind of more English than the English vibe to it, or has had in the past. And but yeah, so there's the suggestion that that model of Englishness is a sort of didn't exist anyway.
Yeah.
So what is it gesturing towards, a sort of nostalgia, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of that whole simpler time narrative where, you know, people want to believe that things were safer and cleaner, and that somehow roles were more clearly defined, and there wasn't, you know, homelessness crises or racism. The whiteness and the affluence that get projected all suggest that, in fact, it is quite a problematic project. And the people that find it most attractive are the ones who imagine that they themselves would be most privileged in that environment.
Were there other replicas?
Yeah, so there's at least one replica in the United States that I'm aware of Anne Hathaway's cottage specifically. I forget where it's based, but there's also other things like the when they were tearing down London Bridge, one of the London bridges across the Thames to upgrade it, a businessman from Arizona bought it and shipped the contents. And I just the other day in a local thrift store, I found a souvenir ashtray depicting London Bridge, Arizona.
No way.
Yeah. And so I think there's a lot of these odd things. And, you know, I mean, in Victoria, we've got a couple of pseudo castles, you know. So I think it isn't even unique to outside of England. There are places in England and the UK in general where they have, you know, especially during the Victorian era, where it suddenly became very popular to be interested in sort of the medieval, early modern past, there are castles that were built up by especially newly rich businessmen to sort of shore up their credibility and also attach themselves to, again, this sort of nostalgic notion of merry old England.
One replica that I've been to is the Globe, when the Globe
Oh, yeah.
in London, which is, that seems a little different, right? Like, do you think that's...
The Globe Project is like a historical reconstruction
right.
project. It's also an authenticity project, and that's where it's problematic, is they're trying to reproduce the past in this particular way and be like, this is how exactly how it was. And of course, we just can't say that. And even the Globe itself is not exactly how it was. It has sound systems, it has lighting. You can't urinate on the ground.
It smells different.
And they like take a dim view of that. Yeah. It's like an educational, yes, and theater history project, whereas something like these replicas of Anne Hathaway's cottage, although they might purport to be that, it quickly becomes apparent that they're not very concerned with that. You know, for instance, Anne Hathaway's cottage having high teas, like that's clearly in no universe was Anne Hathaway and Shakespeare hosting high teas in 16th century England. And, you know, the furniture, they liked to sort of say that the furniture was authentic, that the Anne Hathaway's cottage in Victoria was a replica, but the furniture was authentic, antique. But what they meant by that was that they'd sourced it from all over Europe, and the furniture was authentically old and European from about 14th century to 18th century. So again, like, they weren't actually all that concerned with the project of recreating what it would look like in a particular time so much as creating the appearance, sort of like medieval times, giving people who weren't experts the feeling that they were in a different time.
Hi, my name's Theo and I teach in the English department at Vancouver Island University. You're listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM Nanaimo.
I remember going to the Globe. It was cool in the sense that it felt really different.
No, I agree. And, you know, I think it's a valuable experience. And I mean, you know, experiencing a real thatched cottage, yeah, and seeing that old architecture, even if it's a replica, is also in its way a valuable experience. They tore it down eventually, recently, in the last 10 years. So the family, the son had inherited it from his parents, and it sounds like there were definitely financial troubles. It sounds like maybe some poor investments were made. It sounded a bit like he might have been conned of some of his money, and he had to sell. And there was then a sort of period of time where different people expressed interest in taking it on, but it didn't work out for a variety of reasons. And the city eventually sort of nixed the project, saying that it would cause too much traffic and noise, which seems kind of implausible because it had been there for years and that was fine before. I think honestly what happened was they realized, A, that perhaps its time had come. It would have been extremely expensive. They again would have had to import a master thatcher to like upgrade it. And I think they also realized that perhaps in the spirit of reconciliation, that like it was hard to justify pouring money into something that didn't have any actual historical connection to the location. So while I'm you know, I think like students of medieval and early modern architecture, for instance, for example, would have very much benefited from visiting the structure. They, you know, there are other projects that we can focus on, and, you know, the way it had built itself over the years, which was highly problematic as sort of getting in touch with this purity of the benevolent past, I think made it hard to justify.
It's interesting too, because as I was thinking, looking forward to our conversation, I was thinking about ways in which Shakespeare's works, for instance, can be activated for quite different purposes.
Oh yeah,
which is an understatement in a way. But I was thinking in particular of, again, from a New Zealand perspective, there's quite a lot of translations of, it's at least one translation of a play, Merchant of Venice, into Maori, the indigenous language. And I think there's been translations of the sonnets, and sort of ownership in some ways of some of those great canonical works sort of radically transformed. And I'm wondering if what your thoughts are about, it's not, the problem is not sort of Shakespeare or even the canon necessarily, but I suppose the kind of maybe touristic aspect of it, and the whiteness in a way, right, of the original project. In other words, are there examples that you're aware of where you can maybe have this experience, but it's for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think this isn't my particular area of expertise, right, but there's a lot of really valuable work being done on global Shakespeare,
right,
where they look at, you know, say Indian interpretations of it. There's I think it's a Hamlet that is done where they sort of recontextualize it as existing on the border with Pakistan.
Right.
I think that's where it is. And so like there are groups that are, you know, appreciating it, adapting it, translating it, making it their own. There's a lot of work, you know, that's because Shakespeare was harnessed as an imperialist project, which itself was toxic. The sort of silver lining of that is that there's an enormous awareness of Shakespeare, and there's quite a strong affection for Shakespeare outside of England, and it's still being kind of mobilized in very fascinating ways, some of them positive, some of them negative. Ukraine and Russia are both using Shakespeare as a tool of propaganda, interestingly, right now.
Right.
And there was, I'm aware because a good friend and colleague of mine works on Soviet era Shakespeare. It was like a very big debate during the socialist realism project about whether Shakespeare had a place in the sort of new Russian communist art. And, you know, like people got arrested over which side of that debate they were on. So I think that's maybe not Shakespeare for everyone, but it does say that everybody has something to say about Shakespeare. Which I think is quite fascinating. And I think, you know, as you say, like it can, you know, Shakespeare wasn't exempt from racism and chauvinism of various kinds in his era, but he also wasn't invested in an imperialist project. That something that he gets yoked to later on. And, you know, art is art. And I think that it's got enormous potential for good or ill, basically.
I was going to ask you actually what you think, like if he was, could time travel to the to 1959 and come back to where, what would Shakespeare think of this kind of thing? Not knowing that he, you know, his works themselves constructed history in interesting ways, right? The history plays are not like authentic.
Yeah.
Like they've got a project in the present, right? So what do you think? I mean, it's a bit of a science fiction or enough, but like, so he turns up, what's he thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think he would be fascinated and probably deeply confused. You know, like having a thatched cottage would not be something that would have a like crazy cachet in his day. You know, like he, by the end of his life, he buys a coat of arms. Yeah. He's definitely upwardly mobile. So I think some of it, he would just be bemused by this sort of adoration of the sort of simple Shakespeare life. Mm. I have to believe that as an artist, that he would be pleased that everyone is still, you know, interested in what he's doing in his work. I can't imagine what he would think of what we have done with it, except that I think he was, as you say, he wasn't all that concerned with authenticity himself. I think the adaptation impulse would make perfect sense to him. You know, theater is successful when it sells and when it's dynamic and creative. And so I suspect he wouldn't be as fussed as some people imagine he would be about like, oh, that wasn't in the original. Mm. You know, I think, you know, what we think of as Shakespeare, you know, the perfect text. I mean, most of what we have come down through prompt books. Like he and his players were very collaboratively adapting each performance. So I think in that way, he would be very sympathetic, I suspect.
Yeah, I remember when there were some of these Māori adaptations, and there'd always be sort of comments from some corners of like, well, it's not really Shakespeare, is it? And therefore shouldn't be taken seriously, or it's even some negative commentary that it's sort of besmirching some kind of legacy. But I think you're right that's based on a very kind of fixed idea of what a very mobile art form was, that there wasn't a reverence for this fixed version of a play, but that they were meant to change.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes they absolutely had to change because something that had not been politically sensitive in the past suddenly was. Or vice versa. You know?
Is this part of a larger project you're working on, or is it sort of a one-off? Or
yeah, it's sort of a new direction for me. It started with a conference paper being put on a conference paper for a panel being put on by a friend for the European Shakespeare Association conference. So I presented it in Budapest in 2023, I think. Time is blurring on me. But it had been kind of in the back of my mind for a while. My supervisor from when I was a PhD student does Shakespeare in BC and some, you know, work on that. And for years have been thinking about how weird the Anne Hathaway's cottage reproduction is. And I wanted to do something with it. And I really enjoyed diving into this. And so now I feel this is heading towards a publication for the Shakespeare Yearbook on Reparative Shakespeare. So for the moment, it's a one-off, but I feel like it has legs. I feel like I have more I want to do with it. So I'm still working on finishing off my dissertation into a book project. So it's kind of going to have to wait, but I feel like this is somewhere I can go with.
I'm really looking forward to seeing your presentation at the colloquium, and thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks very much, Theo.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Sarah Crover for joining me in conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies. Music by Greg Bush. The Colloquium series will be back in October 2024 with a presentation by Yoichi Mukai from Modern Languages Studies at VIU titled All Things Language, Linguistics of VIU. For more information, go to ah.viu.ca and click on Colloquium Series. My name's Theo Finnegan. Thanks for listening.